you might well have imagined, my library shelves are well supplied with books on pedagogy and child rearing. Yet it was from none of these, but from a small volume, an anthology of short stories, I began to think along the chain of ideas which I should like to share with you this morning. Isaac Loeb Peretz was an important Yiddish language chronicler and author of mid-European Jewish life at the turn of the century. A literary craftsman of no mean ability, a social critic, a humanist, his works are now available in competent translation, and he is winning for himself the circle of friends and admirers that his creative art deserves. I was particularly struck as I was reading through a collection of his short materials by a vignette which he calls Four Generations, Four Wills. It appeared to me that this sketch from life was in its own way so compelling and so incisive that it might well provide us a springboard for ideas which we should share this morning. Stylistically, Four Generations, Four Wills is somewhat unique in world literature, for it purports to be nothing more than an unadorned, uncommented upon report of the last wills and testaments of four generations in a single family. Its literary quality is superb. I think that you will agree with me that each of the wills delineates in a few bold strokes the depth and the breadth of the man who wrote it. The senior progenitor of this family was named Eliezer. He was an industrious, hard-working craftsman, a man who expected a great deal of himself and of others, a man who knew what was right and what was wrong, and this is the will, the short will, which he left. It is my will that my children remain associates in my timber trade. After my death, they are to make a new enclosure around the cemetery and repair the roof of the synagogue. All my books I leave to my unmarried son, Benjamin. My other sons and sons-in-law have received their share of books when they married. My wife, may she live, should occupy my house by herself, but take in a poor orphan girl to live with her so as not to be lonely. The ceremonies of Kiddush and Havdalah she is to perform herself. She is to have an equal share in the estate with all the other inheritors. Benjamin, the son mentioned in this will, was a man who grew into competency as an adult. He had many of the same qualities of industry and of straightforwardness of his father. And yet he was something more than his father had ever been, for he was a man of rare spirit. There was in him a love of learning and a love of people, a hard head conjoined to a soft heart. And this is the will which Benjamin, the son of Eliezer, left. My time is coming, and I shall soon have the advantage of returning the pledge I have received from him to whom all pledges belong. Man is afraid of his blessed name and of the judgment awaiting him in the next world. But I am going without any misgivings. I have implicit faith in a merciful God, and am firmly convinced that God will only meet to me strict justice, and that he will deal with me further in accordance with his great mercy and loving kindness. All that was really mine in this world, I leave behind only temporarily. And all my possessions, which will not follow me, have never really been mine. Heaven is my witness that I leave them behind without any pang. With regard to my wealth, I leave no will, for I am convinced that the members of my family will either live in peace and unity among themselves, or will divide my wealth among themselves justly and with equity. I am convinced that none of them will hide anything or keep it secret from the other. It is furthermore my wish that my family, that is my wife, may she live, my sons and sons-in-law, should give tithes twice. That is to say, immediately after my death, they should draw up an equitable and just account of my worldly possessions, my estate, furniture, and household affairs, and from that amount take off 1/10 part as my personal share, and distribute this part among the poor for the welfare of my soul. From the remainder, that is, from their real inheritance, they should give tithes a second time on their own account, distributing the money among the poor just as I have always been accustomed to do, of my income, my profits, and my revenue. My epitaph should be very short. The inscription on my tombstone should contain only my name, the name of my father, and the day of my death, nothing more. And I beg that my sons and sons-in-law be not given too much to vanities, or be too anxious to grow rich and prosperous. For the bigger the merchant, the smaller the Jew. I also beg my children to observe the custom of distributing alms, of giving every year on the eve of the new year 1/10 of their profits to charity. Should it sometimes happen that the business does not show any profit at all or even a loss, they should still give charity all the same, for their loss may be only a test from God of blessed name. And above all, I beg my children to study every day, to study at least one page of the Talmud and to read one column of the book, The Beginning of Wisdom. Even the women folk should read on Sundays, on Saturdays, and on the holidays. On the day of the anniversary of my death, they should study the holy law all day long. And the women should distribute charity, and above all, charity given in secret, the recipients to remain unawares of the names of the givers. Benjamin's son, Maurice, outdid his father in wealth and social position. He became a man of some providence and prominence in the Polish Jewish community. He amassed a vast fortune. He was considered a respectable citizen and a respected member of his community. But somehow, in reading the will of Benjamin, of Maurice, we sense that he never quite became the man that his father was. This is his will. A wire is to be sent to Paris, and my funeral must be delayed until my son arrives. I leave in trust £10,000 to be administered by the community, the yearly income to be distributed among the poor. I leave another £10,000 for the endowment of a bed in the new hospital. This bed is to be called after me. Charity should be distributed on the day of my funeral. Money gifts should be sent to all the schools, and both teachers and pupils should follow my casket. A Dayan or other learned and pious man should be hired to recite the Kaddish over me. My tombstone, after the model that I am leaving behind, should be ordered abroad. A certain sum of money should be deposited with the community, and the latter is to undertake the upkeeping of my grave and my tombstone. My business shall be known after the name of Maurice Jr., my son. Then there follows a listing of financial advice to his son unto the management of his business, which we need not go into this morning. Of Maurice Jr., heir of a vast fortune, recipient of the largesse of his father, the last of the four generations of whom we have a will, we need read only, the words which he has left us. I, Maurice Jr., am leaving this world neither in joy nor in grief, but on account of its emptiness. I can no longer live because I no longer have anything to do here. I am absolutely useless because I have outlived my life. I have drunk fully from the goblet of life. I have tasted all the joys and pleasures allotted to me. I have eaten, drunk, and loved my fill. I have been taught many things, but I have never been taught how to live, only how to swallow up life. I have nothing in the world to keep me here, to tie me to it. I have never wanted for anything that would be of value or worth to me. I have taken everything freely, without care, worry, or labor. I have taken it as if from public property. Thus have I taken both things and people. All have willingly met me with a friendly smile, and I have never had a real friend. I inherited a vast fortune, and it grew and increased without my help, without any effort on my part. It grew until it had outgrown me. Frequently my heart wept within me. I was desirous of wanting something, of having something to do. The doctors ordered me to take long walks, to travel, play, take up some sport. But this was not life, only a substitute for life. It was an artificial life, artificial work. I have visited many countries, but I could call none of them my own. I admired many sights and places, but I loved none. I spoke fluently several languages, but I cared for none. I have played with words as if they were balls. I have changed nations and languages as one changes gloves. The whole world was mine, but I was too small and insignificant to grasp it and get a hold of it. My arm was too short to embrace it, and I could not subdue my world. And whatever I could have subdued and acquired, I already found ready and waiting for me. It had been left to me. Everything had been done for me and on my behalf. Everything had been bought for me and on my behalf. My wealth did the rest. Everything had been bought for me. The smile of a friend, the kiss of red lips, even the Kaddish said for the soul of my father. At the utmost, I have paid for things, but I have never been taught to give and to bestow. The trifles, the small things, were too small for me, and the big things were too big, and I had nothing to live for. I am dying because I am barren, both in body and in soul, physically and mentally. There is nothing in me that can either live or make live. It is already long since that I have been alive, for I take no pleasure in life, and now I am quite disgusted with it. I have been treated after the manner in which a peasant treats a pig. I have been stuffed with things since I was a child. The arsenic is upon my table. It is the last drink which will intoxicate me and from which I shall never awake or grow sober. Have I any instructions to leave with regard to my wealth? What for? My fortune has proved my misfortune. Have I to thank anybody? No. I have paid for everything. I have paid also for this, my last drink. We can sympathize in each case with the feelings of the parent as he watched his child, the apple of his eye, grow into competent manhood or fail to achieve his father's dreams. We sense the pride of Eliezer. The pride that he had as he watched Benjamin assume the responsibilities of business, accept the responsibilities of family, discharge the responsibilities of a good citizen, and go even beyond that, begin to evidence traits of mercy and of generosity, of kindliness and gentleness, which raise the saint above the ordinary human being. We can watch the pride of Benjamin as his son, Morris, in his turn, entered the business, developed it, showed himself to be persevering, determined, diligent, understanding, capable. And yet we can also see the growing seed of doubt, the doubt in Benjamin's mind, and Maurice would understand the really basic lessons which he had sought to teach him. Lessons about human relationships. Lessons not of finance, but of family. Lessons not of aggrandizement, but of giving. And we can sense also the torture, the confusion, the trouble, the disbelief, the doubt in the mind of Maurice Sr. as he watched his son to whom he gave so much, grow each day more confused by life, become each hour more overwhelmed by life, less capable even of continuing to live. And as we judge each of these relationships, I wonder if we are not moved to make an observation or two about parenthood in general, its obligations and its opportunities. We're moved most of all by the tragedy of Maurice Jr. I think each of us could read the mind of his father, could see there the self-justification born of absolute utter frustration. But I gave the boy everything. I moved to Warsaw that he might go to the best schools and meet the finest friends. I hired for him a tutor to cultivate him, to travel throughout Europe to expose him to the finest in European culture. I bought him the best clothes. I fed him with the best food. I provided him with the best medical care. I opened every door of advancement that was possible to open for him. Every opportunity which a human being can enjoy in life, I gave him. Why? Why? And as we read the mind of Maurice Sr., as I read it, I was reminded of a scene which took place in my office as a naval chaplain some years ago. The 17-year-old son of a well-to-do San Francisco family had enlisted in the Navy by falsifying his age. He had been sent to San Diego to the recruit training depot there and was engaged in that training when his fair parents finally discovered his whereabouts. I was asked to arrange an interview and, if possible, a reconciliation. I shall never forget that interview. The boy stood in my office, silent, crestfallen. Pain was in his eyes. The mother wept silently. The father mumbled a greeting under his breath, and then his face began to suffuse with livid red, with anger. He almost shouted as he called his son an ingrate. And then in exculpation, he turned to me and he said, "We gave this boy everything. We sacrificed our vacations so that I would work and make more money to buy him a car, to put him in the best school, so that we could buy a home in the right suburb. We sent him to the best camps. I joined a country club so he would have advantage of its athletic facilities and so he could meet their friends who would be useful to him in life. We gave this boy everything. The best of shelter, the best of care, everything. How could he do this to me? How could he do this to us?" The boy, I remember, slowly raised his eyes from the ground and looked painfully and sorrowfully at his father. In a whisper that spoke volumes, said to his father, "Yes, you gave me everything. But you never paid any attention to me." I'll never forget those words. They reminded me that some parents are checkbook parents. They give their children everything, everything the child might want, and many of the things a child might not need. Everything except themselves. Maurice Sr. was a checkbook parent. His child was beautifully, largely provided for. And these checkbook parents are right in one respect. They are right in that they know that a child demands a large investment, but not of cash, but of care. Not of pelf, but of self. The things that we can provide for our children, the wonderful things, the opportunities. These are the dessert. But a child needs the milk of love and the meat of attention if he is to have a healthy diet, a diet which will permit him to grow. And if his diet lacks that substantial food, that body spirit-building food, the dessert, things, gifts, presents, these will only make him sickly. They will not help him to grow. I know that Benjamin, the father of Maurice Sr., understood that a parent must invest in his child attention, counsel, guidance, love, as well as provide him with a good education and many of the finer opportunities of life. Benjamin is a good parent. He was a good man. It almost inevitably follows that a good man makes a good parent. He was an understanding man. He knew the value of people. He respected people. He knew the value of learning and of understanding, and he respected learning, and he showed that in every aspect of his life. And perhaps the most troubling question which Peretz's little story raises is this. If Benjamin was such a capable human being and such a fine parent, why did he fail in part? Why was he unable to transmit that fineness of character, that nobility of purpose, a person which was his? Why was he incapable of transmitting that extra something, that spark which makes a truly fine human being to his son? Why did his son learn only the financial responsibilities of life? And was he unable to develop that moral sensitivity, which is the mark of a great man? Why did this parent fail? And search as we might, we can find no answer. The answer is simply that the question is misdirected. The failure is not in the parent, but in the child. The failure is not in the emotional, moral makeup of the father, but in the emotional, moral makeup of the son, of Maurice Senior, who is simply unable or unwilling or incapable or indifferent to these lessons by example which his father set for him. Sometimes we forget that it is not the parent's only, the parent only is not responsible for the fate of his child. Trace any family tree. You will find in the same generation, often enough, saints and sinners, rogues and righteous men, knights and knaves coming from the same roof, coming from the same table, raised by the same parents, given the same opportunities in life. Our age has tended to forget the responsibilities which rest upon the child. Unfortunately, we have forgotten that most of the way of which leads to adulthood, the child must walk alone. We have sheltered our children from their own obligations, from a responsibility for their own actions. And in this shelter, in this overprotection, we have weakened their will, and we have weakened their character. We are a sophisticated age, an age which has learnt the importance of the social sciences, of psychology and of psychiatry and of sociology. And we have learnt that one can rationalize and find causes within causes for almost every action and almost every occasion. But we have forgotten that ultimately the responsibility for a person's moral actions rests on the person's will or lack of will, character or lack of character at that moment and at that occasion. Principles will tell you that many of the parents who come into their offices for consultation about the deportment and the disciplining of a child do not come to develop with the school as partners some program which will enable the child to learn and to grow, which will teach the child through his mistakes. But they will sit in that office and defend the child and find a thousand and one excuses and rationalizations for the actions of their child. Their child is never guilty. It is the school that is too strict. It is the teacher who is prejudiced. It is the other people in the group, the gang, who are guilty, not that child. And they provide the child 101 opportunities to lay the blame for the child's own weaknesses in their own laps. And it is not there that it belongs. It belongs on the shoulders of the child. The child knows what is right and what is wrong, what is expected of him, what he's expected not to do. And it is folly for parents to find excuses for their child, to seek his happiness, and to forget that his happiness in life will depend upon his growth as a person, his understandings of his responsibilities as a social human being. father of Benjamin knew this lesson well. Jewish homes in early 19th century mid-Europe were homes of straightforward, simple discipline and straightforward, simple love. A child knew what was right, he knew what was wrong, he knew when he had done wrong, he knew he was to be punished, and he never dreamt that that punishment meant that the parents withdrew their love from him. There was a simplicity about these homes which permitted a child to understand what was expected of him and to grow without becoming tortured and confused, without beginning that torture and that confusion which leads to the couch of the psychiatrist. Max Lerner has observed that no culture in all history is so anxious over its parental responsibilities as our own. The University of Chicago conducted an interesting study. They found that one-third of all conversation between adults under the age of 60 and after business hours had to do with children, with the problems of child-rearing, with questions of philosophy and of practice and so on. And they found further that one-half of all conversation between husband and wife had to do with the children. Now, it is good that we have a great deal of new information in child rearing. But preoccupation with the rearing of our child destroys our own effectiveness. Today we are Neo-Freudians, tomorrow we are following the school of Dewey, the next day we are following the school of Spock, the next day Dr. Spock revises his book. And our child, where does our child stand? How does he learn what is expected of him and what is not expected of him? Common sense bathed in love. That is still the best rule any parent will ever discover for raising his child. It is still true, if you look around you, that all too often those who are most sophisticated in the new knowledge are those who make the worst mistakes in the raising of their own. There is no theory which will ever be devised which will be right for every parent and for every child. Of that we can be certain. Every parent is different, every family is different, every child is different. There is no theory which should stand between the child and his parent. We should stop seeing our children only through gazelle-colored glasses and see them as they truly are. Individuals, individual human beings who need something from us as we need something from them and must give something to them. Our age needs to relax. Relax in its child rearing. Not take it so seriously. Some pretty good children were raised long before books were ever written. Long before there was a discipline called psychology. Long before there were medical people called psychiatrists. I do not disparage this new learning. It is important. But I do feel in the innermost part of my being, one needs to be free, to feel at ease with one's children. One needs to feel no obligation to overwhelm them with financial things simply because other children have these financial advantages. And equally, one should feel free, unburdened by, to provide them with a discipline in the home attuned to the latest subtlety of some modern theory. Peretz's story tells us that raising a child does not give us any guarantee, however well-intentioned we may be. No guarantee of the success of our efforts. No guarantee that the sacrifices that we make may not be contemned or prove of little use. And yet I am sure that none of us who have been granted the privilege of parenthood would turn aside from that privilege for a single instant. Whatever its obligations, whatever its responsibilities, whatever its dangers, it is still the richest, finest, and most blessed privilege which a kind God can dower upon any man and upon any woman. Amen.